Let's start with Nick.
Thank you very much. Nick Holmes at SocGen. Just two questions. The first is, what would you say are the key drivers of the favorable P&C pricing at the moment, especially in commercial lines? And to what extent do you think low bond yields will help to maintain pricing discipline and the hard market? And then second question is on the Equitable divestment. Just wondered, do you think there might be an opportunity for further divestment this year? Thank you.
So I suggest that Greg takes the first question. I'll do the number two and three, which was about the lower bond yield and AXA Equitable.
So it's I think the first thing to start with is not only those are the numbers through the half year, we see in the second quarter an acceleration of the firming. I'm not ready yet to call this a hard market in a classic sense, but it's definitely a firming and firm market. And in the second quarter, the plus 5% insurance was plus 8%, and the plus 2.4% in reinsurance was plus 4%. So the second quarter is accelerating and getting better, and I can tell you from just having been across the street, both in the Lloyd's building and in our offices at AXA XL, it's continuing to firm even more. Your question about why is that happening, I think it's a kind of three things, and Thomas said he would cover the last one, so I'll start with that one, which is there is just it's a lower investment yield. So anything long tail is under pressure there. The second is you're seeing, as you look around the industry, you're seeing a pressure on results across many lines of business. You know, we've talked about here about slightly elevated man-made losses. These things are not unique to AXA XL. We almost never write in these areas 100% of our risk. We're taking a share of it on these big, large corporate risks. And so others are experiencing this. So there's a realization that while we haven't destroyed as an industry capital, we have put pressure on earnings and results. And that is a very common theme as I talk to colleagues in the underwriting and I think in the third point, the broking community. Brokers and clients are now accepting of the fact that the price of risk has gone up, that it needs to pay more. Of course, there's the usual give and take of not my account, someone else's account. But the general theme now in the conversation is very much around the price of risk has gone up. So I think those are those three big drivers.
Thank you very much, Greg. So maybe hooking onto the lower bond yields, I also believe that this will be a further driver of price increase. Nevertheless, if I take our own company, one mustn't overestimate the effect because we've always given a guidance that our bond yields will, on the P&C side, decrease by 10 to 20 bips. So we are well in the guidance. Let's assume we would deviate from that by 10 bips. This would translate into a combined ratio or a necessary combined ratio improvement at AXA of 0.2%. So it is feasible, but in general, the low bond yields do cry out for a continued good pricing environment that we have seen so far. On your third question, Nick, on AXA Equitable, our aim is clearly, as we always said, to go to zero shareholding in AXA Equitable. We have so far, between May 10th and now, always found good windows of decreasing our ownership to today 39% or 30% in economic terms. Those transactions have all been done at $20 or above. And so our aim is clearly to continue this trend of the sell downs. But I repeat again, not at any price. We need to find the right moment in the interest of our shareholders.
Thank you very much.
Let's just move one in front. It's difficult to see with the light.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. Ashik Musadi from JP Morgan. Just a couple of questions. First of all, I mean, clearly pricing is moving up in XL. You mentioned volumes are moving up. Having said that, the results were still 0.5 billion, which looks like your earlier expectation as well. So had pricing not moved up so firmly, then clearly these results would have been tough. So what's going on? Can you give a bit more dynamic if there is something we are missing? And just linked to that, I mean, you're expecting 1.4 billion, which is like a run rate of 1 billion going to 1.4 billion next year. That's a big jump again. So what will bridge that gap? That's the second one. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Good. So I would suggest, Greg, you do the first one on has the pricing made it all or hasn't? It's clear the answer is, I guess, hasn't. And then, Gerald, you will talk about the question of how to get from 1 billion to 1.4.
Yeah, I think so. Pricing in the large P&C and reinsurance, so if you look at what we do on the insurance and the reinsurance side, earns in somewhere over 12 to 24 months. If you're writing reinsurance on a treaty basis, you're getting the risk earning in over a two-year period. So the driver of these results is not all about rate. There's a component of rate, but it would be much more that lower rate that we've seen booked in the first half of the year in total, not that 4 and 8%. That's going to come earning later. Also, we tend to have a philosophy that is, again, another example of where XL and AXA share philosophies, is that we take bad news fast and good news slowly. So we're not moving loss ratios right away just because we've gotten a little bit extra rate. We're waiting to see how everything plays out. In that result is a bit of the expense synergies that Gerald talked about, some of the re-underwriting that we've talked about over the past 6 months, and a little bit of, in blunt terms, you know, on the cat side, a little bit of fortuity of there's lower than slightly lower than average on the cat side when you look at prior year development and current year.
The math is quite simple. Meaning that you remember that we said that we would have $500 million of synergies, of which expense synergies would represent $300 million. Let's say it's 260 million euros. In the first half, I mentioned that it was 50 million, so that means that we have 210 million to come. And on top of this, think about the revenue synergies. So, meaning that taking into account the revenue synergies plus the remaining significant part of expense synergies, what is left? Maybe, just to make it simple, 150 million. If it's 150 million, it means 1% of loss ratio. And taking into account what was said about the price increase, I don't believe that it will be extremely difficult to achieve. That's why we are confident.
Go to Farouk there.
Hi, thank you very much. It's quite notable that excluding XL, your attritional loss ratio is really low versus history. Now, some of that's luck and some of it's technical pricing and mix. I just wanted
it's skill all over.
No, I mean, should I just double my number for 2H is what I want to know, question one. So can you give guidance? And secondly, you know, similar kind of question for XL. We're used to, you know, commercial P&C insurers giving us a normalized combined ratio. So could you tell us some of the pluses and minuses we should take into account in re and primary for XL in the first half when we're thinking about a sort of a normalized picture? Thanks.
So I would suggest we cut this answer in half. We first let the very skilled CEOs of France and Europe talk about how they have achieved this 93.3, because the main drivers is coming from Europe. And then, Greg, you will talk about the AXA XL piece and how the loss ratios are developing there. Jacques, why don't you start?
Thank you, Thomas. So for AXA France, we decreased the combined ratio in PSC by 3%, 3 points this year, down to 90.8%. And this decrease is made with three ingredients. First, one part is the decrease of the attritional losses. That is because we are very, very disciplined in underwriting, and we don't go step in, for example, the battle on the retail world between bank insurer and mutual. That's the first thing. The second, we have had an NatCat charges that was lower than last year, and also we had more favorable prior year development in our losses. So we consider that due to the expertise we have in underwriting now, in commercial line and in retail line, due to the transformation of our network with more digitalization, less cost, etc., etc., we are able to sustain this sort of combined ratio for the next years.
Antimo, on the rest of Europe.
Thank you very much. The answer is very similar. So we have really less loss ratios, and this was also the main driver that increased our combined ratio. The second element, we increased the prices in some business lines. And the third element was also a cost discipline. So overall, I would say good technical results and better underwriting with a lot of innovation using data and logically also a better discipline in our costs. So that we make a lot of confidence that we can continue to improve our combined ratio in the couple of next years.
And I think before we go to Greg Farouk, I think it's important when you look at like for like, our prior year developments are in the guidance between 1.5 and 2.5, but relative to some of our competitors, rather at the lower end than at the higher end when you look at these numbers. Greg.
And Frigga, I'll just give you the big levers as I think about them. Gerald's already touched on the expense synergies, right? That we did recognize some in the first quarter, but we expect those in nominal terms to accelerate. The second one of the positive is the aforementioned rate increases, although I will not hesitate to quickly add that those are going to earn in over time, but that they are accelerating, and they're accelerating at a pretty good pace. And CAT, you know, to say normalized CAT, I will say the half year was normal or at expectation. Obviously, in front of us is hurricane season, and it's always earthquake season, so there's no way for me to help you think about normalizing that. And the other piece to the downside in the first half of the year was the large loss, man-made large loss activity. That was a bit of a drag on the first half result. You know, there is to Thomas's point, there's a lot of skill in that, but there's also a amount of fortuity of what happens as we go from here.
Just one quick question. The man-made bit in the attritional loss ratio, how much was that above? Is it a point or half point from what you'd roughly expect?
I look to Gerald.
It's. I would say that it's less than 1 point relative to the global loss ratio. Yeah.
Thank you, Greg. Let's just stay on that side, going to John, so it's easier with the microphone, and then we move over.
Thank you, John Hocking, Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please, on Excel. Firstly, the portfolio reshaping that you spoke about at the full year, and mentioned again today. Could you talk a little bit more in detail about that? And given what's happened with rate and the momentum there, is property cat something that actually you might think about dialing back into a little bit, given what we know now? We didn't know back in the end of the year. Secondly, the multi-year contract that you wrote, I think it came through in Q1. Can you talk a little about why you would do that, given the rates are going up? And is that something you would do now with hindsight, given the rate momentum we've seen year to date? And then finally, I'd just like to hear Greg's view on everybody, I think, in the industry is very keen to say this isn't a hard market. What's your sort of best read in terms of what needs to happen for this to become a hard market? Or is this something that's sort of a rebalancing of pricing just peters out? Or do we need to see some exogenous factor to really drive pricing back into a hard cycle? Thank you.
Greg, I guess these are all for you.
Maybe I just come stand next to you.
Yeah, you can stay straight away.
So the portfolio reshaping, there's nothing that I would say that we've learned so far that would change what we're trying to do, which is a little less short tail, which comes with a little more volatility, and a little more long tail, and then geographically a little more U.S. than international. The CAT piece, to be specific now, property catastrophe treaty reinsurance, so the large book of excess of loss business that we have. The reason it's down 7% is we really went hard at 1-1 to try and move rate, to try and get it closer to a level that we would find acceptable, to come back and say, actually, you know what, we are getting a good return now. We might want to talk collectively as a management to say we want to take more risk. didn't get anywhere near that. And so we cut the book heavily at 1-1. It was about a 1.5% rate increase in that book at 1-1. It's now a 6% rate increase at June and July 1, which is much better, but still a long way to go for what I would ever want to come and say and have a conversation around. I think AXA Group ought to take more of that net. We're just not there yet. So there's nothing in this movement that I've seen that makes us think that the trajectory we're on should change. The large account, it's multi-year. It's right in our sweet spot. It's what's called a global program, so we need to issue compliant policies in about 30 different countries. It's got a captive, which keeps the first $12.5 million of each and every loss net. So that's a gross premium figure that we have. The net written premium is lower. And we bought a fair bit of reinsurance protection on so that what was left to us net in the end was something that we were comfortable as AXA Group to retain. Would I do that again? I would absolutely do that again. That is our core sweet spot that has it was a strength of Legacy XL. It was a strength of Corporate Solutions, AXA Corporate Solutions. It is the calling card of AXA XL, so would definitely do it again. And the third one was so pricing is heading in the right direction to actually, if you went purely for the pricing component of this conversation, you would say a few more points that we'd be getting into a hard market pricing environment. To me, the hard market really happens when you're dictating terms and conditions, when you're making wholesale changes to the way the business is sold. We're not there yet. We're doing things in certain classes that need to happen because as an industry, the results have been challenging, but we're not in that space yet of being able to say that at all or in any measurable fashion. What would have to happen? I think it could be a continued drag on poor under expectation, under hurdle rate returns, but more likely, classically, it's been some kind of capital event that causes that to happen. I haven't seen a turn like this in 30 years of doing it, this hard without any capital destruction, effectively. And so, you know, I think some more tough years of results will keep the momentum going. That's why I'm pretty positive about it. This is not a one-year and done rate increase, certainly not for long-tail lines of business.
Thank you, Greg. Let's move over, and then we can come back. Let's go to Andy. It's the easiest.
Thanks. It's Andy Sinclair from BofA Merrill. Two from me. Firstly, apologies to go back to AXA Equitable Holdings' stake. I just want to check. As I understand it, you might lose a bit of control when you go under 30%. I just wondered if there's any change in strategy for your sell-down of AXA Equitable Holdings once you go below 30. And secondly, it was just on AXA Life Europe. Just wondered if you could give us an update on the process there and when sale proceeds might be available for liquidity. Thanks.
Gérald, would you like to take those two questions?
Yes. First of all, the change of control below 30%. So, of course, we have some agreement and our rights will decrease as long as we will decrease our shareholding. But from a pure financial point of view, there is nothing specific to mention. So that's for the first point. As far as AXA Life Europe is concerned, I could say that like this type of deal, you know, that it's subject to the approval of the supervisor, so it takes some time. I'm still optimistic on the fact that it should take place in the second part of the year.
Thanks.
Let's go to James.
Thanks. It's James Shuck from Citi. I had three questions, please. On AXA XL, the investment income, $500 million on a $39 billion portfolio, looks like annualizes about 2.5% yield. Can you just talk a little bit about what re-risking plans you have on the investment portfolio and directionally which way that yield should trend over by the included in the 2020 target, for example? Secondly, just focusing on France a little bit more, obviously Loi-Pax, I don't think you have a particularly strong presence in employee savings. Could you just talk a little bit about your positioning with Pax and the potential for growth in savings products? Equally, I think you launched a new motor product in France, but I can still see that the policy count of personal motor was still outflows, so you're still losing market share. So what's going on in that part, please? And then finally, on the gearing level, so 25-28 is the target you've talked about and have been pretty insistent on getting to by the end of next year. Is it the bottom end of that range? Would you consider doing buybacks in the midpoint of that range, or do you actually want to get to 25? Thank you.
So, Gérald, I would suggest you take the first question. Jacques, you take the second one on Loi Pacte and Monoto, and maybe to Jacques, you should also talk about our position in the employee saving markets, because it's actually the opposite. We are one of the leaders in France. And then I'll take the last one on the gearing. Gérald.
Okay, so 2.5%. Keep in mind the fact that we went through a PGAP exercise, which means that we marked to market the assets last year. And it means that we can expect, for sure, we have a decline in the interest rates. But as far as AXA XL is concerned, the decline should be less. And at the same time, the decline on the US dollar is less severe than on the euro. So that's it. I believe that as far as your question is, what about the next plan? We will see on the next plan. But anyway, we are still investing today at rates which are quite strong. And keep in mind as well that the plus for XL is that now we can diversify much more our assets than what we did in the past. Roughly speaking, when we invest on a PNC company today, we invest, let's say, 80% in traditional fixed income, which is single A, triple B. But at the same time, we have 20% of alternatives. And this alternative is the tilt which makes that, in the end, we can invest at a higher level. So this is true for the rest of the group. This is true now for XR. The gearing?
You can do the gearing straight away.
No, it's
no,
up
go
to
ahead.
You.
Can do it.
Okay. As far as the gearing is concerned, we have an objective of 25 to 28. It will completely depend at the pace at which we will do the other sell down. You notice what Thomas said. So it's still our intention to go to zero, meaning that if we would sell the totality of XL by the end of 2020, we would be without any doubt at 25%.
And then let's quickly answer the second bit of your question, which was, would you consider share buybacks in the interim period between 25 and 28? Again, we've clearly stated that we have three priorities: integration of XL, sell down of Equitable, and reducing the debt gearing. And we are fully motivated and fully focused on implementing those. And before we haven't implemented these, we are not thinking about anything else. Jacques, Loi Pacte et Monoto.
So, in France, you are right. We have a new Loi Pacte in July. And this Loi Pacte concerns the retirement market, and the objective is to encourage the development of the retirement market. On this market, we are number one, both in group environment, but also in individual environment. And we expect to take advantage of this change in order to develop our business. This business is very profitable because the share of the unit links is more than 50%, and with the new ease to underwrite this business, we will issue the adapted contract by October, and we will be the first insurer probably to be ready to take advantage of this change. And that is normal because we are the largest one on this market. Concerning Monoto, you know that the retail market, you know that in the past years we didn't want to step in the battle between bank insurer and mutual on this retail market. For bank insurer, it was, let's say, a new product in order to offset the decrease of their margin on their retail banking business. For mutual, it was, let's say, the defense of their core business. For us, it was not that position. We prefer to privilege the profitability. It's why we, for in the past 3 years, we regularly increase the profitability of our retail business down to 90% now in terms of combined ratio. And now we consider that the pressure is less important than it used to be. That means that we, thanks to the work we have made during this time on the transformation of our network first, and we decide to take two initiatives this year. First, the launch of two products, one on household called Ma Maison, the other on car, on motor called Mon Auto, leveraging the experience of direct insurance in sophistication of pricing. And secondly, we decide to improve drastically the quality of service we deserve to our customer. Thanks to these two initiatives, we will regain a market share. And for example, for the first half of the year, our negative net contract in motors that last year was at that time of the year 41,000 contract is now only 4,000 contract. Let's say that we are nearly close to zero, and we aim next year to regain market share.
Thank you, Jacques. You can keep it. Let's go to Johnny.
Yeah, hi, it's Johnny Vo from Goldman Sachs. Just three questions. The first question, I guess, is on PYD. You mentioned that you're towards the lower end of your range of 1.5 to 2.5, but I guess the difference is that you've got Excel in the business now, and therefore, by definition, you've said before that Excel itself won't be releasing so much reserves, and it was relatively marginal for this half. So is it feasible to expect the PYD to move much more than where it is, or are you really at a reasonable level, particularly given like France released quite a lot? That's the first question. The second question is just in relation to capital generation and the low interest rate environment. Obviously it's having an impact. Is this or can this have an impact on remittances of the group overall? And the final question is just in relation to AXA Investment Management. Obviously it's a tough environment, as you've highlighted, very difficult. What are you doing operationally or strategically within that business to potentially have a turnaround there? Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. I suggest, Gérald, you take the first two questions, the one on PYD, lower range, lower end of the range, what does XL mean? And the second one, capital generation versus low interest. And since Alban will soon be responsible for the whole investment, including AXA IM, we'll ask him afterwards on what operationally will be done in AXA IM.
So, as far as the... I believe that... I encourage you to go to page B33. I don't want you, Johnny, to flip too much pages, but... I believe it's quite interesting to see the evolution. You remember that when we moved from 1 to 2 to 1.5 to 2.5 at the group level, we said that it was justified by the fact that we had a level of reserves, of reserving ratio, which was pretty high. And look at the situation today, it's even more relevant. So that's why I believe that you can consider that at the group level, the 1.5 to 2.5 could be used including for the totality of the group, even if you have significant differences from one country to another. You remember, Johnny, that I mentioned last time that we, taking into account when I commented in November on the PGAP of XL, that you could not expand, you should not expand in the foreseeable future any release. That's still true. But nevertheless, at the group level, the comment of the 1.5 to 2.5 is still relevant. The second question was about capital generation in a low interest rate environment. First of all, I believe that the way I see it is that on a local solvency position, so long as we are pretty well matched, I don't believe that there are so much constraints. On the life side, so the key question won't be so much on the life side because the margin, as I said, on the life side, we should keep a strong level of margin, especially on the spread business. It's much more a problem on the, it could be a problem on the P&C side, but taking it into account the obvious improvement on the technical side, I don't have any specific fear as far as remittance is concerned.
When you say matched on the life side, are you saying matched assets to the UFR or matched assets economically?
No, I mean matching assets to the liabilities from an economic point of view. From an economic point of view, so that's mostly it.
And when you think about the shift of the earnings mix, financial risk versus technical risk, obviously we've moved away quite significantly from some of these questionable spaces.
Yes.
Alban on AXA IM.
So on AXA IM, you really have two businesses. One which is a traditional institutional business, which, as you know, is being commoditized globally. So what you do is what you would expect, which is to work on the simplification of the structure and the reduction of our expenses in order to be to offset the pressure that we have on fees. And then we have a very strong position on the second part of the business, which is about alternatives, so real assets and structured credit, and we want to go full steam on that one where the margins are much higher. So it's really as you would see in a business which is commoditized on one hand and high value added on the other hand.
Let's move on. Can't see.
Thank you very much. Peter Edit from Kepler Cheuvreux. Three questions, please. Firstly, sorry to make Greg stand up again, but on XL, you reported a 26.3% expense ratio in the first half of this year, and obviously, you know, we've heard there's a lot of restructuring costs to come. When you knock those off, you get to a pretty low number. So I'm just wondering, you know, if that's sustainable, and I guess also given that the 1.4 billion was set before, you know, pricing upward pressure has been more than you anticipated at the time, should we think about the 1.4 actually as probably being pretty conservative given the developments, you know, you've seen to date? And then two quick numbers questions, please. Firstly, on the slide we were just on, actually, I hope I wasn't asleep just now and you didn't mention it, Gerald, but would you be able to give us the reserving ratio excluding XL, just so we've got the like-for-like development? And then finally, on the reinvestment yield, you know, you give that overall. Is it possible to split it life and non-life? And if we had it at the end of the period, rather than across it, that would be very helpful as well. Thank you.
Good. Greg is used to standing up, and he'll certainly answer to your question, but because he'll be too humble to talk about the 1.4 billion, the 1.4 billion will stay the 1.4 billion. Greg.
Thank you for that, Thomas. yeah, and on the expense ratio side, yes, rate helps a little bit, but the focus of all the efforts is very much on finishing up integration. We fortunately now have gotten through what's called the consultation period in all the core European countries, so we're able to really execute hard on the last bit of people leadership announcements and get going on that point. And then we've got a plan to deliver that all the way through. I'd say, if anything, we've been holding back collectively at AXA XL on any kind of real hiring other than a few core positions to make sure we got through that process in a fair way. And so there's a kind of a little bit of a balance against the run rate at this point. It would be a little bit hotter when you would normalize for some of those positions that we didn't hire just because we're waiting to get through consultation. But the expense synergies are on track. That ratio should play through.
Thank you, Greg. And then Gerald on the two items, reserving ratio excluding XL and reinvestment yield, life, non-life.
So the reserving ratio excluding XL would be at 218, meaning that it would be up compared with the 213 that was the level of reserving ratio both half year 18 and full year 18. Then your question, Peter, on the reinvestment yield, I would say that it's not so easy to answer. The way I would answer it is, so you know that we have a difference in terms of duration. So the duration in life is more something like 9 years, where it's 5 years on the PNC side. So, but at the same time, on the PNC side, we have a bit more flexibility, as I said before, in terms of diversification in alternatives. So that's what I can tell you. So the reinvestment for the time being, you know, the reinvestment, we could say that, as we said, in US dollars, if it's roughly at 2.5 for PNC, and if it's around 1.5 on euros, 2.5 for dollars in PNC, roughly 1.5 for euros in PNC, it would be slightly higher in life. But I don't believe that the difference will be so important. And I remind you on top that in life, for significant part of our reserves in life, it's a spread business. So long as it's a spread business, it's not the absolute number which counts, but much more the guaranteed rate. And you have all the details in the appendices on the guaranteed rate. And as you can notice, roughly speaking across the board, guaranteed rate over the first half dropped by 20 basis points. So that's what I can tell you about the reinvestment rate.
Good. Let's move on. Yes, Oliver.
Oliver Steele, Deutsche Bank. Two questions. I think what one of the things that stands out from those results is just how well the original AXA is doing. And I remember one of my competitors asking about a year ago whether we should be expecting a tick-up in the progress of your five-year plan. And I think the answer at the time was to play it down. But equally, we are seeing an improvement, quite a sharp improvement coming through both in PNC and in protection and in health. In protection, you're actually now beating your own targets. In fact, in PNC, you're beating your own targets. As Farouk would put it, is that just luck, or actually can you continue to improve on the results that you've seen today? So that's question one. Second one's a bit shorter, which is the 12 points improvement in the solvency ratio in the first half from operational delivery. How much of that is sort of genuine underlying operational delivery, and, you know, is there anything exceptional in that?
Good. I suggest, thank you, Oliver. I take the first question, then Gerald will do the second one. I repeat again what I said to Farouk earlier. These numbers are not luck. These numbers are skill. Certainly those two gentlemen and their colleagues, amongst others, have worked extremely hard to get there. And when I look at them, they are continuously willing and motivated to even further improve. We set in our Ambition 2020 that we want to aim at an underlying earnings per share improvement between 3 and 7% over the cycle between 2016 and 2020. And we are, as you've seen on the full year, but also now, well on this journey. If I take your words, Oliver, old AXA is working well, but new AXA is also working well. So we are reaffirming our targets of Ambition 2020 because, again, we will measure at the end of the period where we are. Today we can see that we are still fully in line in this range that we've given to ourselves, 3 to 7%. Depending on the development of capital markets. So we will stick to that because, as you have heard earlier, there is also a question on how do the capital markets evolve. We started with low interest rates in 2016. It improved slightly, and we are rolling back into low interest rates. And therefore, for us, it's very clear we do everything we can to do operationally better every time. 5% increase in underlying performance is quite tough, and it makes me very proud to see that these two gentlemen with their colleagues have achieved it. They are willing to continue all their efforts to do the same again. But again, we have what is in our hands and we have what is not in our hands, and therefore we want to stick to what we said in June 2016. Gerald, the second question.
Yes, Oliver. So we had indeed a strong 12% operating return in the first half, which was slightly higher than the 15 to 20 points annual guidance that we gave you. The difference is due to we had some favorable operating variance in the first half. It's a couple of points, notably from France and from Switzerland. And it could be at least partially explained by the fact that what I explained before, that means that we have a strong reserving position, as you know, and our Solvency II, we are using BEL, Best Estimate Liabilities, so this explains also why we had some positive operational variance.
I'm sorry, I can't see. Let's just move one row back. The light is to the other side, exactly.
Hi, thank you. It's William Hawkins from KBW. Yes,
sorry, William.
Gilles, just coming back to a couple of your answers just there. The 12 percentage point increase in the Solvency II ratio from operating items, can you tell us how much of that came from own funds and how much came from the SCR, please? And then secondly, could you add a bit more colour in terms of what you the slide you just referred us to for the life investment margin? There's been a small drift, as you highlighted. Could you maybe give us a bit more colour about what's driving that small drift in terms of, obviously, yields are going to be the big negative, but then crediting rates, not guarantees, and business mix may be offsetting that. And I'm just trying to get clear in my mind, you know, how those moving parts are working. And then to the extent that the guidance for next year is between 55 and 65, you know, 65 is almost no change, 55 is a massive change. So can you just give us, you know, a little bit more colour on how you think that figure is drifting from here? Thank you.
Gérald, three questions for you.
Yeah. Okay, two questions. So the first one is on funds 5%. So we have most of it, I believe. Do we have the we should have a detail on this? It's but yes, because the way we are managing it makes that it's mostly from the FR. You can see it, look at the shareholders' equity, so there is a direct link between what I said on the shareholders' equity and the FR, so it's mostly it. So, but yes, and the SCR, we try to monitor the SCR so that we limit its part of our risk appetite. The 55, 65, and...
operationally gone down or up in the first half?
Albon, why don't you? I mean, you have got the details, huh?
Yes,
you want to come here?
But I think it's on the slide itself. But the SCR has slightly gone up, as you, see, the required capital, from 30.2 to 30.5.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I meant just from the operating items, though. Presumably markets have taken the SCR up.
Yes, so the SCR would not have gone up operationally, fundamentally, and it's so the operating return comes from the development of the AFR.
Thank you, Alban. Gérald, on the...
On the 55 to 65, I believe that we are above 65. We'll go, and that's unavoidable, between 55 and 65, but I would say that it should be normally at a relatively low pace. Why? For the reason I just explained before. And I could comment, I believe that you have all the elements in the document, and notably in the appendix, you will see that, as I said before, the guaranteed rates are going down as well. So that's why we can expect that it will go down, but at a relatively slow pace.
Andrew?
Yes, Andrew Crean of Autonomous. A couple of questions. Actually, following up on that one, when you set that 55-65, the 55 was the interest rates now are below where you set them. So if you're going to come in higher than that, it must mean essentially that what you're offering the customer is less than what you'd planned. I suppose a general question, what is the customer proposition when investment rates are 1.5% in Europe? What does the customer get from that? And then second question, before you did the Excel deal, you were quite focused on acquiring in health protection and SME commercial. I'm not sure XL fits into SME commercial too easily. If you do still have plans in those areas, do you think you will execute them organically, some of the examples you gave in the health market, or do you think there will have to be more M&A?
Okay, thank you, Andrew, for the two questions. For the first one, I would like to Jacques, maybe to that we give the answer together, because you are confronted to this question of what do we do in the low-rate environment, and since France is a very, very strong unit-linked market, they've thought very well about it. What is the best proposition? And just in general, it is absolutely true that in a market where interest rates are very low, you need to fundamentally rethink what is the right balance between risk and upside. And certainly most of our markets have drifted more in the space of capital-light instruments, where you have on a long duration a more unit-linked proposition with a limited guarantee, and when I talk about guarantee, more about the capital protection, but where there's also a much higher upside. And Jacques, if you could give some examples of what you have done with real estate, with private equity, as very innovative propositions in France.
Yeah. As you know, we have developed in the past years, let's say, a renewal of our proposition to our client, because we are facing this regular decrease of the yields. And what we have to sell to them is something on one side, which guarantee, let's say, a part of their investment, but on the other side, which permits them to get opportunities. And on unit-link, for example, we develop successively in the year 2008, we develop what we called les fonds à fenêtre, which is not something we can develop because of the low interest, but that was a sort of promise of at the same time, let's say, guaranteeing their capital, but giving some upside. That was unit link. We were the first one in the French market to develop it. And in the years 2011 or 12, we developed unit link on real estate. We are one of the largest players in France. And that is something very interesting, because our people believe in real estate. They trust real estate, our customers, and we can make some package very interesting, and we reach a large success. And now we are working on unit link on infrastructure. That's something also very interesting. And with all this initiative, first, secondly, with the training of our people, taking into account the profile of our clients, and also the duration of their investment, and thanks to robot also to be, let's say, regular with what I call the duty of advice, because that's very important. We are able to develop regularly, if you look on the long period, the part of unit link in our investment for our customers. On the other side also, on the marketing side, it's true that we privilege the customers that are ready to take some risk, and we don't look specially to those who want, guarantee and only guarantee. That also our marketing policy. All that together, that permit us to develop our business, to develop our profitability on a regular manner. And we have also a very prudent reserving in order to face, let's say, a long period of low interest rate, but to give at the same time a gain, as we say in France, contract to our clients. So it's something we have managed in the past, and we will continue to manage. And we are not we trust in the future. We are very, very confident.
Thank you, Jacques. Let's maybe take another example from Asia. Etienne Boileron, who will succeed Gérald Alain, is still currently the CEO of Hong Kong. As you've seen, the numbers in Hong Kong have moved very well, and the Asian proposition is a very different one to the French. So what can you tell us?
Yes, so first of all, there was a change in regulation called EN15 some years ago, which prevented the unit-linked business called ILAS in Hong Kong to work efficiently because the distribution had no means to be remunerated. And we have started a few months ago, reinitiated a strong lobbying to the government and the regulator to favor the unit-linked business again in this context of decreasing interest rates, first point. Second point, we tended to lose market share in the past in Hong Kong because it had become again a general account market. So what we have done over the recent months is to revamp completely our product range and to refocus our products on participating products with a much lower level of guarantees and a higher level of benefits illustration. And you can do that through a slightly more aggressive asset allocation. So the NBV margin is slightly higher, the risk is lower, and this is what this kind of product, which explains that AXA in Hong Kong is regaining market share, is increasing its agency force again.
Thank you, Etienne. Andrew, to your second question, which was around acquisitions, health and protection SME. Our strategy is very clear. We want to focus ourselves on risks that are less focused on financial market risks, so-called technical risks, health and protection, and the commercial space, from SME to reinsurance. We have made a significant shift over the last couple of years in this regard. I've just mentioned earlier that if we already exclude the remaining ownership of AXA Equitable, we are at 82% of our earnings coming from those technical risks. So the additional journey to go is getting harder and not that much anymore. We will certainly continue to focus our organic efforts in growing significantly higher in the preferred segments, which we have seen consistently in every presentation that we have given. Nevertheless, we will also always have a look at opportunities in those spaces where we still have white spaces. You have certainly seen that with the file of AXA Tianping, where we have bought the remaining 50% of our P&C operations in China. Nevertheless, I would like to remind you that we are fully focused on our three priorities: integration of XL, deleveraging, and reducing our stake in AXA Equitable, which should not distract us. We should not be distracted. So we have to manage this in a good balance. I guess we need to go back to the questions that might be in the webcast. Lois?
Yeah, there's one question on the webcast from Raul Parikh from JP Morgan. He says, given declining interest rates, how are you looking at money allocation in alternative assets and real estate? Do you have any specific targets there?
Very good, Gérald. You can easily answer that question.
No problem to answer a question. I believe that I covered this point already. I said that today we aim at we have, roughly speaking, including real estate, 100 billion, which are investing in alternatives, but including real estate. We want to increase it progressively, maybe by 10 billion more, to give you a flavor per year. And roughly speaking, again, it means that we will invest 80% in fixed income and 20% in a mix of alternatives. What is important for us is to capture this premium from alternatives. We can afford it because it's a premium corresponding to liquidity. It doesn't mean that we will take much risk in terms of taking, I would say, much non-investment grade risk, not at all. But exactly on the way Jacques explained that for our own policyholders, we try to capture the premium from infrastructure, from private equity, and so on. That's exactly what we try to do and to adapt depending on the different portfolios. So in a nutshell, yes, we will increase, but progressively, because, again, our job is still to match assets and liabilities, so it can be a part, but a marginal part, and we focus much more on alternative credit.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Any more questions in the room? Last chance. This is not the case. Then I would really like to thank you for coming. Thank you for asking your questions. And I wish you a great summer, certainly for those of you who haven't had their summer holidays yet. Thank you very much.